KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in this next hour, Scott Simon, the host of National Public Radio's Weekend Edition, joins us in the hour ahead. We'll discuss his latest book, Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, in praise of adoption. Scott and his wife, Caroline, adopted two daughters born in China, and he tells their family story, as well as a number of other adoption stories, highlighting the fact, as he writes in his book, that, quote, real parenthood is earned, end of quote. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum. Scott Simon is best known as the host of National Public Radio's Weekend Edition with Scott Simon and the author of the novels Pretty Birds and Windy City, the memoir Home and Away, and a historical work on Jackie Robinson. But to the Chinese authorities, he and his wife Caroline had to get approval from to adopt their two daughters in Nanchang, China. He described himself as a sports book author, lest they prevent him from and his wife from adopting. Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other is the story of the international and transracial adoption by the Simons of their two Chinese daughters, but it's also a book, as its subtitle says, in praise of adoption, and it features stories of a number of people who have adopted or have been adopted. The latter category, as Scott Simon points out, being one that includes Moses, Aristotle, Tolstoy, and John Lennon. The numbers of formal legal adoptions here in the United States are in decline, and Scott Simon highlights how adoptions, despite the joys to many of those like Scott and Caroline Simon who do adopt, can be a difficult and challenging process, though one with great and inimitable ultimate rewards. Scott Simon joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, and good to see you and be with you again.
Nice to be with you again, Michael.
And we just discovered something that we have in common. We both have studies with cat litter boxes in them. Actually, my cat just died, but
there may be
a correlation then between creativity or writing. And,
well, I'm going to look into this, and if it turns out that Faulkner, Norman Mailer, Graham Greene all had cat litter boxes in their studies, I think we're on to something. You know, well, it's the cat litter that makes us creative.
It's a dissertation. Yes. At least, if nothing else. You write about the difficulty initially of, trying to make a baby. And
yeah,
it's not romantic, as you say. And as I said, I admired your candor in going through this, as well as the indignity of, feeling of failure, really, that goes with not having fertility. And that must have been a tough thing for you to put down on paper.
Well, as you know, in the book, I play it for laughs over several pages where I talk about what it's like to go to an assistant fertility. I just describe my experience in the assisted fertility clinic where you go into a room and you're given a stack of, magazines that make Playboy look like The Economist. And videos, and you wonder, where were these when I was a teenager? And you're given, a little plastic cup. And
and always the same one-liner too. After you turn the cup,
first time I turned it in, I said to the woman behind the desk, I said, I filled a couple of cups just in case you need any extra. And she sighed, literally sighed, and said, oh, every man makes that joke.
You did play it for laughs, but you also
I come back to a serious point because you do feel, and there's a kind of grieving that goes on. You feel that at some cellular level that you can't get a hand on, that you can't control, you have failed the person that you love most in the world. That, you've failed to do fundamentally what we're all put on this earth to do, we're told, which is to keep life going, keep creation going.
Though you can say with zero population that maybe that's not a necessity anymore to feel that way.
Yeah, but you don't feel that way at the time. Let's put it this way. And you also feel, because my wife and I were ready to cap our love by starting a family, that that you failed the person that you love most in the world. Now, now that we are happily the parents of two daughters, whom we happen to have adopted, that seems a little ancient. But when I was writing the book, it all came back. And I think this is something that a lot of people deal with. And I played it for laughs in a sense because it still hurts, and I can deal with it at the level where I'm making fun of it and laughing. But I do put a couple paragraphs in there where I talk about how deeply it hurt us. Because there were, my wife, Caroline, a former KQED intern.
Intern emeritus, we call that.
Intern emeritus. We went through a kind of grieving. It was a rough period, no doubt about it. But now we're so happy with our children.
Boy, are you joyful. It's brimming over in your book. And yeah. I must say that when you talk about the cellular level, mm-hmm. as soon as you saw the photographs of your daughters, and this defies logic to some extent, as soon as you saw them, you know, you were in love. You accepted them as flesh and blood. When they were in your arms.
I'm pulling away from the mic. I'm going to take out my wallet where I still have the picture. I'm going to show you. I'm going to pass it across to you, Michael.
Okay.
The picture of our thumbnail size photo of Elise that we first got.
This was the photo that you fell in love with on first sight.
Exactly.
There's a danger that I may have paternal feelings here, too, because she is indeed a beauty.
All right. I'll say, well, look, if you're willing to babysit, I think we can work something out.
Well, I think it's a wonderful story. And you even use the word miracle.
I think it is a miracle. And look, I don't want to get I come unequipped to handle a conversation that talks about whether or not they're miracles. Let's just say an unaccountable happening in life, and I think it's as miraculous as childbirth. And also, you rattle off a number of names of people of note who have been adopted. I think in the Bay Area, we obviously have to add Steve Jobs. And people who've changed history who have been adopted. And I think doing even just a little bit of research, you understand. I think, without trying to sound like I know what I'm talking about scientifically, I think as human beings we are wired to take care of children who are left behind, who are relinquished. I think that is...
Some of us
aren't perhaps wired to have children at all.
Well, you write about that in your book. And, you know, kids in the back seats of cars and all this, having children and getting pregnant and not necessarily being cut out for parenthood, let alone...
Yeah.
People who can't have children and all of the kind of, feeling that erupts it.
But I think the instinct to reach out and to take care of children is as old as childbirth. And it's not lost on me. When you can read ancient accounts, there would be terrible battles and people would come over the burned and charred landscape and they would find infants squalling in the embers and they would pick up the babies of their enemies, the people they had slaughtered, and raised them as their own. I mean, that was going on for centuries. When Pharaoh's daughter put her arms down into the bulrushes and picked up the baby Moses, he was in a Hebrew blanket. She didn't think this was a kid who'd been born to another member of the Egyptian royal family, but she raised him within the family. So this is, I think it's a very powerful instinct.
Unless you believe Freud, that Moses really was an Egyptian, or at least the possibilities.
Well, and I don't disbelieve Freud, but I'm certainly ill-equipped to have a conversation with Sigmund Freud.
Not one of your fields of expertise. But again, Scott Simon's book is Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, in Praise of Adoption. And there's some... a moment when you pick up your daughter, your first daughter, and I remember people saying that they came back from China and they were surprised at how little there was of crying or squalling of infants. Mm-hmm. And you pick her up and she's crying and you're saying, she hates us.
Yeah. Well, she looking back on this now, I think this was a very positive sign. For one thing, it indicates that she's a very spirited young lady, which she still is.
In fact, she's everything they told you she was.
Absolutely. Funny, curious, demanding, cranky. All of that stuff we got in the so-called dossier that they send you. If you can imagine a dossier on a girl who was at that point 11 months old. And I think it means that she had powerfully connected with whoever was taking care of her before in the institution. And suddenly here we were. These strangers, smelled funny, unfamiliar to her, big noses. We were kissing her, showering her with affection, something that she wasn't used to. And she cried for more or less straight for a couple of days. But the picture that's on the front of the book with my ravishingly beautiful wife and ravishingly beautiful older daughter was taken just 4 days after we got her. And
big grin on her face.
Oh, my God. A grin, that confides some of her mischief and a lot of her ingenuity. And I think, just her sheer ebullience and love, the way that she has so much character and so much personality, it's bubbling out of her. I love this photo.
It bubbles out of you, and it's refreshing and wonderful. And yet at the same time, you talk about the difficulties, the vicissitudes one goes through, some of them just attendant upon parenthood in general. But, somebody thinking, oh, well, it's different, isn't it, because it's not your genes. Or you couldn't breastfeed her, so she's going to be different, all of these kinds of things.
You mean the people that talk about mother's milk? The Leche League.
The La Leche people, exactly. Yeah.
You know, and God bless, but like a lot of people who, you know, I know people who believe Bikram yoga is the key to civilization. I know people, you know, who believe that certain diets are the key to civilization. And I certainly, it's great, but, you know, it's hard for my wife and I to sit through a 15-minute lecture from someone about how, when they talk about the importance of breastfeeding, that essentially lead you to believe that the best thing you could possibly do for your child is not possible in our case. Everybody has – I think when you adopt, you become just a little bit more sensitive to that. It does count for something. You know, it's a rough way to begin in life, isn't it, when you're relinquished. And that's something that needs some explanation in your life, and it's a sensitivity that one way or another you might carry for life.
Well, I was ignorant of Nancy Verrier until I read your book, this woman who put forth this theory about the wound that babies have when they leave the bonding of their mothers and are adopted. And I thought, this sounds pretty theoretical. I mean, I guess you were somewhat skeptical about it too.
I was somewhat skeptical. The more I read it over. In fact, the more I talked to her, she's a wonderful exponent of her own views. Wound, I think, is the problem that I have. I mean, as I say in the book, I sometimes think I suffered a primal wound when I wasn't born as Warren Buffett's son.
Good line.
Steve Levitt, the Freakonomics professor, who I assume you've had on the show.
We have.
And Steve and his wife, Jeanette, have adopted two little girls from China after they lost a son, Andrew, who was about a year old. And Steve, I think, without pretending to be able to answer Nancy psychologically, I think makes a very good point. Which is that children have a genius for not only absorbing and remembering things, they also have a genius for forgetting what they don't need to survive. And Steve is rather skeptical of the idea that this is a wound that persists, which is why I'm more comfortable with sensitivity or irritation. I mean, it counts for something. In their formative months, neither of our daughters were held when they craved it, were changed when they needed to be as opposed to a schedule, were fed when they were hungry, they were fed on a schedule. This can be a trigger. But also, I think, Steve Inskeep is in the book. He was adopted. I think also youngsters who are adopted, look, we all have something in life, don't we? And life is growing up and absorbing losses and getting better and getting stronger because of it. As Jeff Seller, who's in the book, the Broadway producer, says, if you want to make the fact that you're adopted a wound that you never get over for the rest of your life, you can do that. But why do that? You've got a whole life to live. And in fact, why not just use it as another piece of experience that makes you wiser, better, and stronger?
Well, you have the whole continuum here of those who do use it as some sense of a wound and those who almost disregard it as being of any significance whatsoever. But yeah. I was struck when you mentioned Steve Levitt by the fact that he said it was easy to adopt these children from China. It wasn't easy for the Simons.
Well, I think we probably had about the same timetable, but, you know, it's time, and particularly when you haven't done it before and your adoption gets approved, and then nothing happens. And at first we were told it would be 9 months. It wound up being 18 months. And that's when your mind begins to play tricks on you. Your friends come up to you and say, what's going on with your adoption? And you say, well, we've been approved. Everything's fine. And they go, well, everything's fine, right? Well, then why is it taking so long? And then everybody has a friend who knows somebody who read something on the web, that somebody who flies the United route from Hong Kong said this or that, and something has happened to adoptions. And that's when your mind can begin to play tricks on you, and you wonder if it's ever going to result in a child. Now that it's over, obviously we have two wonderful children, and it's great. But at the moment, you go through a lot of anxiety.
Chris, the sad thing is that so many young girls are born in China that aren't wanted, and that's really why there's this plethora of
there are millions, yeah,
babies available. And you talk about transracial adoptions, international, but transracial. About 10%, you point out in the book, are transracial. And get into this whole thing about the policy of the black social workers and how
that was, I think, 1972, and the National Association of Black Social Workers issued a paper, a policy that was influential for many years and is influential with some people even today. They have since revised it. But what they said, and I'll paraphrase it, I quote from it exactly in the book, is that they were opposed to interracial adoptions, and they said that race was a legitimate way to define society and experience, and that specifically talking about African American youngsters, white families that adopted African American youngsters could not be sufficiently good parents because they would approach their ethnicity as a strange factor in their life and not something that they shared. And they have since adjusted that policy. Their policy nowadays is there should be a preference for African American families adopting African American youngsters, but that when there are no African American families available, certainly that shouldn't stand in the way of a white family or an Asian family or any kind of family adopting an African American youngster. Now, I think for a lot of reasons the policy needed to be changed, because the first interest should be the interest of putting a child in a loving home, regardless of ethnicity. I have covered too many wars, tribal conflagrations around the world for me to think that ethnicity is a legitimate way to define our experience on this planet. I'm sorry. I've just seen too much destruction from people who put too much emphasis on race and ethnicity. But also, the fact of life in our country now, we are getting all mixed up. I mean, you know, we have a president of the United States now from Chicago, born in Hawaii, of mixed ancestry. His children are of mixed ancestry.
Grew up in Indonesia. Some say doesn't have a birth certificate. He's really from Kenya.
I was going to leave that part out. On your show, I don't have to, I think, make that kind of explanation. And as I think people in Kenya point out, you have a man of Luo descent who has become president of the United States at a time that that's unthinkable, by the way, in Kenya, where the Luos are still a very oppressed minority. We're just becoming mixed up. You know, I mean, my family is French and Spanish Jewish and Irish and now two girls from China.
And yet you see in your daughter's traits that you have.
Well, inevitably, because they absorb them just by being with us.
But it's almost like, in a sense, they become your genetic issue, so to speak.
It's amazing how quickly you forget that. I mean, both of our daughters seem to be right. Or we know for sure, a seven-year-old, she writes with her left hand. My wife is left-handed. And when we first noticed that, I said, darling, she must get that from your side of the family. And then a few minutes later, we both burst out laughing because, no, in fact, she gets that from some guy in China.
We're talking to Scott Simon. His new book is Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, in praise of adoption. And there is, as I said, many stories in here, but ultimately you seem to have, a thesis that families are made best, of course, when there is a loving home that's provided and when the parents adore the child, but also that race, blood, lineage, nationality, all those things really ultimately don't matter. Families are families.
Yes, I absolutely believe that. Now, we are absolutely cognizant of our girls' ethnicity, and two of their godparents happen to be Chinese, and we will do what we can to expose them to Chinese culture. And hope that it takes. I also know, as the parent of a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, almost 4-year-old, we can't get them to eat broccoli. So, you know, so what decisions they're going to make about how they relate to their Chinese heritage in the years ahead, I can't sit here and pretend that I know how important it's going to be to them. And
the author Richard Rodriguez, who lives here in San Francisco?
Yes.
He lives in a Chinese neighborhood for the most part, and he says, I'm Chinese. I mean, he shops at Chinese stores. Most of his neighbors are Chinese.
Flying here yesterday, I was on a plane with lots of tourists from China. I seemed to be seated in the Chinese section. I was wound up with the Chinese tour group. And in any event, of course, I was showing pictures of our children on my iPhone. And I would say to people, you know, I'm from a Chinese family, just like you. Look at our daughters. Yeah, all of these things are, I think, getting mixed up. But you know, another thing, when you have children, they are so many things before they are any kind of ethnicity. They're hungry, they're thirsty, they're tired, they're cranky, they're funny. You see all of that before you see ethnicity. And I worry about people who see only their ethnicity.
I must tell you, just last week I went to the birthday party of Amy Tan's husband, Lou DeMattei, and she had put together this collage of pictures. And
the dogs were there, of course.
Of course. Yeah. But there were pictures of Lou in Chinese outfits, and it said Lou Tan, you know, and it's very clever and funny stuff.
I'm Baba. That's what our girls call me, Baba, which is Mandarin for father. And my colleague Robert Siegel, who went over to China on a reporting trip, well, they were there when the earthquake occurred, he had assumed that this was some little private family nickname. And then he gets over to China and he keeps, you know, he says, there are a billion Babas here. Why didn't I know that before?
Now, there's a moment in your book, and of course, you know, people who know Scott Simon and have a great deal of affection for him know that he's witty and soft and charming and all of that. But there comes a moment in this book when there's a refusal of a darker child, and it's
not from our family,
Simons. No,
yeah.
Another couple. Yeah. And you know, you say that person should rot in hell. I mean,
you don't mince any words.
Yeah. It's something you mentioned, South Pacific, which is kind of an interesting reference to it. But it really gets you angry, gets you hot.
Yeah, it gets me angry. This was not a couple. This was a man who was there to adopt a child, and his wife wasn't there. And I forget what explanations they made as to how they couldn't travel. This is when we were in China to adopt Elise, our first daughter. And you know, we don't know what happened. My wife and I decided there must have been some other story that we didn't know. But the child was put into his arms, and they already had two other Chinese children, but they said that this baby was just too dark, wouldn't fit into their family, and he refused to accept her. Now, the Chinese make provision for this. There is, I think, a two-day period or something in which you can decide, oh, I've made a horrible mistake, but they keep all the fees, and you never adopt a child from China again. And this was hurtful. We just thought that this was absolutely hideous. I happened to be sitting in the lobby with Elise of the hotel when he was hustled out into a cab and hustled to the airport, and I was really seized with a fury. I couldn't imagine anybody. I took it personally because I have a daughter like that. You know, it wasn't an intellectual proposition for me anymore. Now, my wife and I have told each other maybe something else was going on. Maybe he knew that a divorce was imminent and adopting a child wasn't a good idea.
It's a better narrative to construct almost in a way.
Yeah. You know, the fact is we don't know, and I do say that he should rot in hell, but of course I don't really know all the circumstances, and so my saying that won't make him rot in hell under any circumstance.
You never know. When you talk about your wife smiling at Elise and you say, she never smiled at me like that. I thought, there's some jealousy implicit in this.
No. I mean, you see my wife smile. It's on the cover of the book. You see that. And I do say that I've occasionally made my wife smile, or maybe even more than occasionally, but I have never made her smile like that.
Talking to Scott Simon, who you can plainly see is still in the rapture of fatherhood. And I'm going to invite those of you listening to join us. We're talking about adoption. We're talking about stories that have to do, obviously, with adoption. And I know there are many that you may have. If you have a narrative, please bring it to our attention. Make it cogent and succinct, I might add. But we'd certainly like to hear from you. And if you just have some thoughts about these rather, challenging questions about interracial adoption and international adoption, please feel free to join us as well. Or if you just want to talk to Scott Simon, because he has so many fans and admirers, our phone lines are open to you and we welcome your calls. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. You can join us now at that toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to us, and we welcome your emails as well. It's forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. The host of NPR's Weekend Edition, Scott Simon, with us for the hour. When we return, your calls and emails. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we're spending the hour with Scott Simon, the host of NPR's Weekend Edition, talking about his new book, Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, which chronicles his experience adopting two little girls from China, and also gives us many stories and moving stories, including a name that many of you NPR listeners will recognize, Frank DeFord, who, of course, has been on this program and who Scott Simon and I both have unvarnished respect for as a sports writer. And his story is particularly interesting because, I mean, it's sad in a way. Of course, they lost a child, but they didn't think they were going to adopt a girl.
Yeah, they had Frank and Carol lost a child named Alex, and in fact
it's
wrote
a famous
book.
About,
book famous
yeah,
book,
yeah.
Alex, the Life of a Child, cystic fibrosis, yeah. I believe. And because of that, they thought they couldn't have a child in the traditional manner. It would be unwise to risk that again. So they and Frank was over 40 and figured that he would be at the back of the line for any domestic adoption program. So they looked overseas. He had a brother who lived in the Philippines. They made a contact in the Philippines. And there was a young woman who was born in the Philippines who had been I guess I tip my hand. There was a baby born in the Philippines who had been promised to the Malaysian ambassador to the Philippines. And this woman who was active in adoptions called him up and said, "We have a baby for you, a beautiful baby girl." And he said, "Oh, sorry, it has to be a boy." And that's how Frank and Carol DeFord got the young girl, who is Scarlett, who is now in her late 20s and a jewelry designer in New York. And, we talk about the importance, or sometimes I think relative lack of importance, of ethnic identification. Frank and Carol were mostly just grateful that this little girl was healthy, because they'd been through such a tragic and sad, grievous experience with their daughter Alex. So they were just first and last. Scarlett was healthy.
And also talk about her tattoo, which I found pretty moving.
Oh my gosh! I'm talking to Scarlett, and she lifts up her shirt, and she has a tattoo with the initials FCA for Alex. And S for Scarlett, every member of her family, because she has grown up with the sense that Alex has been a member of her family. So she said it's not as if she felt she was some kind of a replacement daughter for Alex. On the contrary, she felt that Alex was always looking over her. And as Frank said, Frank says, do you know how many marriages break up after you lose a child? He said, Carol and I have been very happy. I'm not saying that would have happened. And I'm not saying that Scarlett saved us, but she made us whole.
Yeah, it's a very, very touching story. We're going to bring our callers into this. You actually, you and your wife almost adopted a couple of Ethiopian boys, or it seemed like
I had first kind of felt that fatherly instinct when I was at an orphanage in Ethiopia and just playing with these boys in the orphanage and picking them up and rolling around the ground with them and laughing with them. And I felt a very powerful instinct then. But at the time we began to investigate adoption programs, the Ethiopian program had a very long waiting list. So we just felt we couldn't wait that long. And, it's funny. My wife and I fell in love in Chinatown in New York. She had an apartment on Mott Street. And, you look for signs. And we thought, we fell in love in Chinatown, so Chinese children, why not?
Yeah, you say some nice things about Chinatown in New York, and I'm thinking to myself, Scott must know Chinatown in San Francisco.
Oh, yes, of course.
But infinitely superior to Chinatown in New
York. Of course. Of course it is. I know that.
We got a line of callers for you. Let's go to some of them and find out what they have to say or ask. Nicole is up first. Nicole, hi.
Hi. I have a question for you. I have two children, one of which I adopted from Guatemala, and he's 11 now. But he and I always imagined that I would create or maintain a important cultural piece for him, for us, for our whole family. And it's never really come off the ground. And part of that, I think, is my son has Tourette syndrome and some other kind of issues that come from that. But I have like a real guilt around not embracing and not making sure he speaks Spanish and not making sure he has, a whole world of Guatemalan friends around him. And I haven't done that because I guess in my mind I kept saying, well, it's how much I love him and how important our family is. And then there are these other issues that are pressing. But honestly, I do feel he's 11 now and there's something that I haven't given him. And I'm not even sure how to do it with all these other priorities. And I guess I wanted to ask you how important and how big a link am I missing for him?
I think, without pretending to give Dr. Phil-like advice, I've never really seen the show, so I shouldn't make fun of Dr. Phil. Firstly, I would tell you not to feel guilty. No matter what you feel, you haven't given your son, you have given him a lot. You have adopted a real little boy. You haven't, adopted just a vessel of culture. My wife and I try and introduce – my wife, as Michael knows, is French, and our little girls are fluent in French, which I think is a great thing to be. They have far greater facility in French than they do in Chinese. In Mandarin, so far, the only word that they've taken home from their Mandarin class seems to be pigu, which means derriere. And it's a great word. It's a great word. We use it all the time. But, you know, we think in a peculiar way, at some point in their lives, they will stand a better chance to know the majesty and the nobility of Chinese culture and civilization by growing up in our household than if they'd stayed in orphanages and were put into farm or factory work from the time they were, you know, they were 12 or 13. I think they will have a chance to know and study their culture. But as we also say, you know, you can take the girl to you can lead the girl to Mandarin class, but you can't make her speak Chinese. And you know, they're real people, and they it is not when my wife and I were in line at O'Hare to fly over to China for the first time to pick up Elise, we were behind a Chinese American family from Kansas, and they were seeing their son offer his junior year abroad. And my wife said, oh, where are you going in China for your junior year abroad? And he said, well, actually, I'm a religion major. I'm going to Kenya. And that, you know, that's not lost on me. You know, as I said, we can't get our daughters to eat broccoli. So I think our children, you know, will wind up steering their lives that way. And I'll bet at some point, maybe in his adolescence, your son might be more interested on his own in exploring and cherishing his Guatemalan heritage. And that'll be more effective than if you're trying to, you know, ram it down his throat.
Don't you feel the diminution of guilt here thanks to Dr. Simon?
Thank you
for the call.
That's why I'm here.
It's good wisdom, actually. Let me get another caller on. Linda joins us. Hi, Linda.
Oh, hi, Scott Simon. What an honor. I want to tell you, I'm a mother of two China-born children, a son and a daughter. Mm-hmm. I'll make this quickly. My daughter was left in a train station, and that's a good thing, as you know. She was found right away. People who loved her made sure that she was found. But here's my story and my point. I left her 3 weeks ago at a train station in Bryn Mawr. She's at Bryn Mawr College. And as I stood at that train station, I realized the pain I felt, the loss I felt, was nothing compared to what her birth mother felt when she was forced to let her go. I have two points. One is that it's not about not wanting their daughters in China. It's about needing a son.
Yeah.
And the second point is that, and we have a son. That's about a one-child policy. We have to be really careful about how we judge the people of China. And the second thing is I want to thank you so much throughout your book. You were so careful to use adoption in the past tense. Our children are not in a constant state of having had been adopted.
Yeah.
They were adopted. It's past tense. A paper process, as I see it, mostly completed. They don't spend their lives being adopted. They were adopted, and they are our children.
Well said. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're absolutely right. And, I mean, as I write in the book, I cannot imagine, knowing how much my wife and I love our children, I cannot imagine the pain of their birth mothers in leaving them in places where they knew that they would be found. And many of them, you know, stand and watch in a concealed place to try and make certain their children are picked up. My wife and I mean, in a better world, a better China, we hope to meet our children's birth mother someday and thank them for the bravery they had, really, in persisting to go ahead and give birth to those children and try and doing what they did, which provides the blessing in our life. And my wife and I just hope that we can give our daughters lives that are worthy of their sacrifice.
Though you do tell a story in the book about, in fact, a young, really outstanding young man from Oakland and his sister.
Thomas Lauderdale, the head of the group Pink Martini,
And his sister went and found her birth parents and didn't necessarily
in Ohio
work out all that well.
Well, she met her birth parents. She began to spend time with them in that family. And for one reason or another, she got caught up in drugs and died an early death. And, you know, as I say in the book, I don't think you can grade adoptions any more than you can grade lives. And as Kirby Lauderdale, Thomas Lauderdale is a musical genius, went to Harvard. As Kirby says, we put him on his feet and we just began to follow. And he said, we got a lot of unmerited praise from people who would say, see, you take in a homeless kid and you love him and you give him Cheerios and he becomes a genius like Tom Lauderdale. As Kirby Lauderdale says, we finally concluded we don't deserve half the praise we got for Thomas's achievements. And we probably don't deserve half the blame we heap on ourselves for what happened in the life of his younger sister. And look, you know, the Kennedys and the Bushes have their stories like that, too. And they certainly weren't adopted.
How do you respond to the kind of celebrity adoptions, the Mia Farrow and Angelina Jolie, where they just make one adoption after another, and there's a bit of derision, especially in the tabloids and the national magazines that cover this, suggesting that these are like charm bracelet pieces or something that they're collecting.
You know, at first, I mean, I don't know them. So I'm reluctant to, from the outside, judge any family situation. I just, you know, I wouldn't want people to do that with us. Secondly, you know, I'm glad they opened a door for adoption for a lot of people. Because my wife and I have grown to feel very strongly about that. When I say adoption is a good thing to do, I don't mean because it reduces our carbon footprint or it's good in any social way. I mean it's a flesh and blood miracle that takes place in your life. It's good for you. I hope it's good for all concerned. And there are just so many clever ways of having families these days.
And there's so many people who are hungry for children.
Yes,
I mean,
exactly.
Longing, deeply yearning for children.
Exactly. And they're there. They're here in the world right now.
Let me go to another caller, and that's you, Sam. Hi. Thanks for waiting. Join us.
Oh, hi. Nice to talk with you, Scott and Michael. I love your shows. Basically, I have this question about closed and open adoptions. I think you brought up the point just a little while ago about the birth mother having to go through so much pain.
Yeah.
Certain countries would, only have closed adoptions, like we adopted from India, and it's a closed adoption system, and there's no way to trace back the birth mother. What are the consequences in terms of the child, you know, in a later stage of life, and you know, what is the, what do you think about that, and you know, what is the general philosophy about this whole issue? I hope you get what I'm trying to get at.
I'll explain. Closed adoptions is when there's no record kept of the birth mother and there's no way of a child.
Which is the way it was always done for many, many years.
The way it was done for decades, yeah. and people thought that was good. And I think most every state, I could be corrected on that. The laws have been changed by
principally because of the recognition of hereditary diseases and so forth that people want to know.
I think any child should have the right to be able to find that information. In China, what makes it, I don't want to say impossible, it makes it very difficult at the moment is obviously, as we've talked about, these youngsters are relinquished by their mothers and don't want to be found because they could be subject to criminal penalties. My wife and I are big believers in open adoptions. We have a number of friends. We write about, in fact, some families here in the book have open adoptions. Jeff Seller, the theatrical producer, for example, Ed and Ann Burke in Chicago. And we think this is great because it gives children the information they need to contact their parents. And in many instances, they actually can grow up knowing their parents, knowing their birth parents. And I think that's wonderful. Gay families have been, I think, particularly in the forefront of this because they have been closed out of a lot of adoption programs. And we might have done an open adoption for our second child, except it seemed best to return to China. I've heard since this book has come out from a woman who has, I think, a very good idea. She would like to approach Secretary Clinton, and maybe we can help do that, to see if she can treat with the Chinese government to create a DNA registry of youngsters who were adopted. So that at one point, maybe in the future, in a changed world, even in a changed China, it might be possible to trace that line back and have families be able to find each other. I think that would be a terrific idea.
Yeah. Let me thank the caller. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. In the meantime, let me go to some of your emails. Richard writes, very insightful show as always. Thank you, Scott. I appreciate you taking this on, and I don't mean to sound on the attack or insulting to those who mean well, but here's what I'm trying to understand. Adopting children from Asia and Africa seems to be hugely popular, bordering on the fashionable. I know couples who are in the process, but no one can really clarify for me why they adopt from other nations and not the United States. There are so many children in the United States from birth to age 18, desperately in need of a loving home here. More will spend their time in a difficult and challenging foster care system and may never know the love of a good family. Why doesn't the adoption of U.S.-born children get more press or more support? And rather than being charitable, isn't it somewhat patronizing for well-off Americans to adopt third-world children as if somehow that makes us more noble than looking in our own backyard?
I would, without knowing that man, I would guess that he doesn't have children. But I don't know, and I don't mean to dismiss it. Look, I could be defensive. I'll choose not to. As my wife and I, like to say, Our daughters happen to be adopted from China, and China is on the other side of the world. But you know what? It's only on the other side of the world. I mean, it's a world that we share, and, you know.
Well, it's a flat earth now, as Tom Friedman keeps telling us, a global village, right?
Yeah, so, and I mean, I'm just guessing that half of what you and I are wearing probably comes from China. So, the fact that we should adopt two daughters who come from China it doesn't strike me in this world nowadays as remarkable.
You have better sartorial taste, however, so
here's another. I do think some domestic programs can be difficult depending on the municipality. It can take a lot longer time and many more court proceedings, and that is sometimes off-putting to families.
Andrea writes, I'm sitting at work listening and was so struck by your story of the man who rejected the baby girl in China. After we adopted our daughter, I was discussing adoption with friends who were having difficulty conceiving, and the husband said to me that he could never love an adopted child as much as a birth child. Our friendship ended because I realized in that moment that we had nothing in common. When people ask us why we adopted our daughter from China, the answer is always because that is where she was. And briefly, about race, I'm Caucasian. My husband is half Chinese and half Caucasian. Our oldest is mixed Asian-Caucasian, and our youngest is full Chinese, so we figure we cover the whole range of possibility.
sometimes when my wife and our children, or I, my wife being from France, if we're in France, we're from Europe, we sometimes draw some interested stares, and I like to turn around and say, yep, you're looking at a typical American family here.
Here's Jeanette. Thank you for waiting. Join us, please.
Sure. Thank you. I'm really pleased by this whole conversation. I was adopted in the 60s into a Catholic family that already had one kid, and after giving it the old Catholic try for many years, had not had another, so they sought an adoption. So that was me. Then naturally, thereafter, my mother immediately got pregnant, and then again. So I have three siblings who are natural to my parents and I, and the adopted kid. It was never a thing, not even for a minute. Although I didn't look like anyone in my household. And in fact, it was always, when I was listening to the race part, I was particularly struck by that. Because it was not, it never was an issue that I didn't look like my parents or my sibling, and they didn't much look like each other either. But then when it came time for me to become a mother, I kind of wanted to see myself somewhere. So I went ahead and had a baby, who of course naturally looks nothing like me and entirely like my husband. And so I gave up on that, and we didn't want to just have one. We wanted a second child. And so we looked into adoption, and we were particularly struck by the number of children in the Bay Area who needed families, and they happened to be mostly African-American children. Mm-hmm. We were classified as far too white for that, and this was in the mid-90s. And I was so angry to see that very weekend that we were told too white that there was literally a parade at Jack London Square of foster black babies and children, young children, available for adoption, come one, come all, African-American families. Mm-hmm. I was just so annoyed by that. And when I was listening to this conversation and heard that, it's when I picked up the phone, because I really was so angry. We had everything to give, and we're shut down on race.
Well, Jeanette,
and I don't even know what mine is.
I'm glad you called, and I thank you for that, an important call. And here's another caller addressing that subject that was brought up in the email about why go overseas and adopt. Holly, you have some perspective on that? Please.
Thank you very much. As always, a wonderful show. I'm the single mother of a now 3-year-old girl I adopted from Vietnam when she was 6.5 months. And I just thought I'd let the listeners know what some of the pros and cons are of adopting domestically and internationally. They're both wonderful options. If you do a domestic adoption in the U.S., it does now tend to be open, which is really wonderful for the child. You tend to have more medical and family history, at least from the birth mother. You're often there at the birth or soon after. But some of the disadvantages are that, one, the timing is really unpredictable. The cost is really unpredictable. I mean, you can get a call at any time saying, we have a woman in labor, do you want the baby? Or it could take several years. So being single and being self-employed, mm-hmm. I knew that it would be difficult for me to handle the first couple of months on my own. And so I was more interested in having a slightly older infant. Being self-employed, it was helpful for me to have at least somewhat of a time frame that I could tell my clients when I'd be unavailable. I felt that there'd be a greater need because babies in the U.S., I knew there'd be parents for. And also, it was just an intuitive gut thing. My mother had lived in Bangkok and traveled all over Asia and was an Asian art scholar before she met my dad. I had a deep connection to Asia. I had been to Vietnam with her. And when Vietnam opened, I just knew that's where my baby was. Mm-hmm. And now all of my family, my cousins say, oh, my God, she's the reincarnation of our little Russian Jewish grandmother. And Anderson says, hola, I'm Mexican. So it really is just a very personal choice, and there's it's a wonderful option no matter which way you go.
And we thank you for the call, Scott.
I look, that's a wonderful story and amplifies everything that we feel. I mean, you know, it's a small world, and I don't know as putting up barriers is useful for anybody. And I've also, when people call up, I think people who seem to be a little bit too intent on saying, well, you know, why didn't you adopt from down the street as opposed to on the other side of the world? I mean, I'd be very surprised if there are people who are genuinely interested, you know, who would adopt a hamster. I think we should stop looking for reasons to not bring children into our lives.
Scott Simon's book again is Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, In Praise of Adoption. He'll be at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco tonight at 7 p.m. And you're listening to Forum. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And more of your calls. Peter, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Oh, hi. This is just a really wonderful program. Thank you very much. And perhaps very appropriate to the International Day of Peace. But I wanted to ask Scott, if I might, to take a try at this question. So for an older man who has become newly economically able to consider a wife and child, could you discuss, your feelings about how it would be emotionally and maybe socially in today's world, that choice between having your own child and adopting as a conscious act?
Oh, I mean, I don't know as I'm equipped to talk. When you're talking about an older man who is newly, economically able to have a wife and family, you're talking about a cousin or talking about yourself?
So that's why he would be in that position.
Well, I think having children is a wonderful thing to do, but I don't know as I felt that at every point in my life. By the time I became a father, I think I was in a much better position to be a better father. I don't think it's the kind of thing where you can weigh it on a scale. You really have to feel a call. You know, I don't think you make a list of pros and cons. I think it's something you want to do, or it's something that you don't feel adds anything to your life, or something you're even a little scared of doing.
Boy, did you and your wife feel the call. I mean,
yeah,
you really
absolutely.
Did.
Yeah.
Let me thank Peter for the call, his call, and go to some more of your emails. Vicki writes, in any discussion of adoption, you must at least acknowledge that a woman gave birth and will be grieving her whole life. This is inevitably true whatever the circumstances. Whoever she is, most likely she would have liked to have been in circumstances that would have allowed her to keep her child. Some birth fathers should be included in this category, and I will know that we are dealing appropriately with unfortunate children when the children and their mothers are adopted together. By contrast, here's a listener named Greg who says, I have had friends show up in China and the child they brought out did not match the picture and had serious medical problems with cerebral palsy. It ended up being unclear which baby they ended up taking home, if the documents were made up or what. You state that there's an innate desire of people to love children, take care of them. I guess this does not also occur in China, where thousands are abandoned each year. And now there is a gender disparity with an excess of 20 and 30-year-old men with no women to marry. Look at the contrast in those two emails.
But I'll say, yeah. I mean, certainly right statistically about that last part, but I doubt very much that any woman in China who relinquishes her baby wants to do that. Quite the opposite.
Here's a listener named Nirvana who says, just a quick question. What religion will you and your wife give the girls?
I don't know. I don't think you give that to people. We will provide them with experience, including, by the way, agnosticism and atheism. I mean, we want to.
They are options.
Pardon me? Yeah, they are. No, they are options. Right now, they're exposed to Judaism. Do I say Episcopalianism?
Sure.
Is that quite the word?
And
they will get to know more. Our 7-year-old in particular is asking some increasingly sharp questions about God, existence, and life for that matter. And we think it's important that youngsters have we give our youngsters some kind of spiritual background so that they know that, you know, life isn't just about getting that next ice cream cone, that it's about morals and values and all that sort of thing. But what they'll have in the end, I don't know. They'll make their own decisions.
Well, speaking about the next ice cream cone, you unabashedly say you spoil your daughters.
I'm the spoiler-in-chief in our family, yes. My wife doesn't know how they learned the English word no, because they would have had to have learned it from me.
It's fun spoiling.
Probably
isn't it?
From Sesame Street.
Probably.
I had to guess, yeah.
A few more emails. Here's Irma. That's how she wants her name pronounced. She's clear about that. I look forward to reading Scott's book on a long flight tomorrow. We're parents through adoption, and one day my spouse said to me, "Oh, my God, I just had a terrible thought. If we'd had a biological child, we wouldn't have Tony." And yeah. I couldn't fathom the thought of being the mother to anyone but this terrific boy. We have an open adoption that includes the extended family in South Texas of our sons, 2 siblings, biological father. Sadly, his birth mom died just several years ago. Aunts and uncles, cousins from both sides of the birth family. As our son said one day when he was about 9, "I sure have a lot of grandmothers." We feel enormously blessed by our good fortune, and thanks for the great program, and thank you for that. Another listener says, "I'm an adoptive father. We have an open adoption of our son, Joseph. Adoption is hard. The reason it is difficult and getting more challenging is the disparity between supply and demand. Demand is much, much larger than supply, and this means that price goes up. Price doesn't just mean money. It's also time and difficulty."
Mm. You know, as my wife says, there's no such thing as an accidental adoption. A woman doesn't wake up in the morning and say, "Oh, my God, I'm adopting." And I think in adoptive families, we have to say things out loud to each other. Tell each other how precious we are to each other, how much we mean to each other, that maybe in other families you let slide or assume. And I think all of that also speaks to what a wonderful thing adoption is.
Okay. I'll say how terrific it is to have you as a colleague.
Oh, wonderful to have you
and
as a colleague.
I thank you for this book, and thank you for your work, and thank you for being with us this hour.
My pleasure.
Scott Simon's book again is Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.